This is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro. Now on the internet at communityradio.coop.
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. My name is Ernie Hood. I'm a freelance science writer. And the purpose of the program is to bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science, both here in the Triangle area and elsewhere. Each week, we focus on one particular scientific topic of interest, talk to an expert on the subject, and give you the opportunity to call in with your questions or comments. And you are welcome to do that at any time, and you can give us a call at 929-9601. And if you happen to be listening on the internet, you just need to add the area code 919 to that number, 929-9601. And we've recently put up a website for the program, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/tilde radio in vivo. And that tilde is the little squiggly character that's the shift upper right key on your keyboard. My guest today on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Jaime Mancilla, who is a postdoctoral research associate at UNC Chapel Hill in the Department of Otolaryngology. And I'm proud that I can actually pronounce that the first time.
I had trouble with that at the beginning.
Jaime's specialty is neurobiology, and today we're going to talk about Jaime's work and generally where we stand in the fascinating study of the final frontier, the human brain. Jaime was born in Chile and attended the University of Maryland and got his PhD from the University of Chicago and was a postdoc at Brown University, which happens to be where I matriculated as an undergraduate. Jaime joined the Paul Manis Lab at UNC in 2004. And Jaime is also one of my colleagues here at the radio station. Every Saturday night from 7 to 10, he hosts a music program called Fiesta Latina under the guise of DJ Jaime. Does that mean I can call myself DJ Ernie?
Sure.
Well, okay. Jaime, thanks for coming in and joining us on Radio In Vivo today.
Sure, no problem.
Jaime, usually I like to talk about a guest's specific work first and then broaden the discussion to the field in general. But I think this time around it might be more effective to actually reverse that flow and explore the field first before we hear about your specific research interests. And that way, hopefully, we'll get a context to actually have a good understanding of your research pursuits. So let's talk in general first about neurobiology. What are the hot topics in the world of neurobiology these days?
Well, neurobiology is a broad field, and there's a lot of specialties that go into the study of neurobiology. And so you have different types of approaches from molecular biology all the way to behavior. And there's been many advances at all levels. The molecular biology took off with the genetics boom that about 5 to 10 years ago started. And so that has pushed the field pretty far. And so you can develop genetic models of diseases in animals. And so that's one of the approaches that has helped the field. And we've learned a lot from that. There's also behavioral type experiments have been done that have shed light on a lot of issues. And in between, there's a hierarchy of from going all the way from molecules to behavior, mm-hmm. and I'm somewhere in the middle where I study cells and interaction of cells.
Right.
And so one of the things that I like to point out, which I found very fascinating, is what we talked about the other day, where research at Brown University in the labs of John Donahue, and also at Duke University in the lab of Miguel Nicolelis, they developed a technique where they could record from cells in a monkey brain and figure out what those cells were doing. And so the experiment was set up so that the monkey was trained to move a cursor on a screen, and meanwhile the monkey was doing that, the researchers were recording the activity of cells in the motor cortex. And so this is activity of hundreds of cells. And what they learned from that is that when the monkey made a movement in a certain direction, there's a particular pattern of activity that was formed. And they recorded that pattern, and they were able to interpret that pattern. Mm-hmm. And so what they ended up doing is implanting a chip into the brain of the monkey. And all the monkey had to do was think about moving the cursor, and the computer that was connected to the chip would actually move the cursor for the monkey.
Right.
And so what fascinated me is the fact that I knew the people that were doing the research at Brown University.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most research you encounter doesn't go too far into clinical practices.
Sure.
But this research in a couple of years was already in the clinic. And so they developed a chip that you could implant into patients that are quadriplegic. And so they had this example that I looked at in one of their posters at the Society for Neuroscience meeting, in which they reported what the patient did with this chip. So he was able to turn on lights through a computer, turn on lights in a room. He was able to do emailing and all sorts of activity like that. So that was one example where the research in the lab was directly applied.
Right.
To humans. So I thought that was very fascinating.
Absolutely. Has that work actually proliferated outward further into the clinic? I know that it's still experimental, but is that starting to reach?
Well, there's a company set up by the Brown Group that is doing this type of implantations, and I think that's still limited. I don't think it's wide practice right now, but it's still limited. But they've reported from certain patients that have had the chip implanted. And so it gives more credibility to a field, I guess, because you can actually see the results.
Well, that was a remarkable piece of work, and certainly got a lot of publicity when it came out. What are the long-ranging implications, let's say specifically, of that type of work? Undoubtedly, it will not just be stop it. Helping quadriplegics manipulate the outside world.
Right, and so one of the things that happens in science is the science is improves with the technology. So as the technology gets better, we are able to do more experiments and develop more techniques to actually apply the research. So my field, what I do is a little further down from that. And so we were talking from going from behavior to molecules. So what they were doing is below behavior, and what I'm doing is a little below what they were doing. And so I'm studying individual cells. And so my major interest is the circuitry of the brain. So certain areas, I've mostly specialized in the cerebral cortex, which is the region of the brain that does the processing of sensory information, is responsible for consciousness and stuff like that.
Sure.
And so that's the highest level of information processing. And so that was my interest. Mm-hmm. And understanding what the circuitry of that is, so you can apply it. One of the things you can do is like build chips to implant that'll replace the circuitry that's already in place when there's damage to it. Or you could also, you know, build computer models to further understand what is going on. So a lot of the research that I do goes into computer models, and like that we can understand the proper function of the brain. And so my major interest is finding out, you know, how exactly this complex machinery that we have in our head is actually functioning. And so one of the analogies I use is sort of a computer. So what I do is sort of like if somebody handed you a computer and asked you to figure out what the computer was doing. And so the way I go about it is the same way you would go about studying the computer. First of all, you have to take it apart And then you have to study the individual elements and see what the individual elements are doing.
Sure, but the brain, of course, is far more complex than any computer ever built so far.
Far more complex, exactly. And so we just... pecking away at small parts of the brain and understanding small areas. So,
sure.
Like what I do is limited to a particular area,
right?
And that's maybe a thousandth of the size of the brain, or it's a pretty small area,
right?
So,
how far can we take that analogy between the brain and a computer, Jaime? Does it have limitations, or is ultimately the brain explainable somewhere down the line in the future with that analogy to a computer? Is our brain just a supercomputer?
Well, in one sense, yes, because it's built up by small elements that are connected in a circuit-like fashion, just like you would connect a computer. And so that's one of the reasons why you can build these electronic devices that can supplement what the brain is doing in small parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one way, it is analogous, but the other part that isn't is that the brain is constantly changing. And so there's constant change, constant growth, and also there's this diminution of the activity in certain areas, and there's expansion and retraction of processes and things like that. So it's adaptive, and it's constantly being modified. And so learning is a process that happens through changes at small levels in the connection between cells, between neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And so the connection between neurons are called synapses,
right?
And those can adapt. And so that's one of the basic fundamental building blocks of learning. And so
sure.
these processes, so unless you can build a computer that can do that kind of thing, that can change its connection strength and change its connection pattern with repeated stimulation or whatever, then...
In other words, a computer that would not only have memory and self-replicating memory, but learning.
Exactly. But, it's like the field is pretty new, and we still have a lot to learn, so we're very far from being able to reproduce what the brain is doing. I mean, what a computer can do, our brain can do much easier.
Sure, but it's the electrical activity in those connections right now that's being studied by groups like yours. Is that
right?
Correct?
So neurons connect to each other through long processes that are called axons,
mm-hmm.
And so these axons can travel from your brain all the way down your spinal cord. And so, for example, the motor neurons that control the movement of your legs go from your brain all the way down to the lumbar spinal cord. And so that's a long way to travel, and it's a long way for information to travel. So the way that they've adapted to transmit information is through regenerative currents, electrical currents. And so they have these regenerative currents that travel all the way down to the spinal cord, and then at the end they release a neurotransmitter that connects to another cell. The neurotransmitter activates conductances in the other cell, and then that... other cell interprets all the information it's getting and transmits it further down the line and eventually to your muscle.
And, of course, this is all going on constantly and virtually instantaneously.
Exactly. So the speed of transmission is sub-millisecond. So it's pretty fast.
Which is what allows us to actually move and think and control our muscles and breathe and everything else, right?
Exactly. So what attracted me to the study of the nervous system is that it's the essence of what organisms do. So it controls everything. It's the computer of the human body or of organisms, of biological organisms. That's what controls everything you do.
My guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Jaime Mancilla, who is a postdoc at UNC Chapel Hill, and we are discussing neurobiology and the brain, and you are welcome to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 929-9601, and we'd love to have your questions. Jaime, to press on, what about the various senses? I know that there's a lot of research in each and every one of those, including things like our balance and other things that you don't normally think of as senses as such.
Right. Yeah, so I mean that's my specialty is a sensory systems, and so there's many different systems. So there's a somatosensory system which receives information from your receptors in your skin and your muscle and the receptors in your internal organs, and that tells you the activity level in your body at that time. There is also receptors, you know, your photoreceptors in your eye that transmit light information. There is auditory system, you know, hearing, olfaction, sense of smell. And these, what is interesting about these senses is that certain animals have developed them further than others. And so, for example, birds have a visual system that's highly developed because they need to see from great distances up in the sky and they need to detect a prey. So they've developed a visual system to maximize their functioning. And other animals have developed other systems which are different from the systems we have. For example, the infrared detectors in snakes. So they've developed a system to detect their prey. And so animals have developed certain specializations, and ours, of course, is our cerebral cortex and our capacity to reason. But that's just one example of a specialization in an animal. So,
sure. I came across researching the program for last week. Our guest last week was Dr. Henry Greenside from the physics department at Duke, and we were talking about Einstein mainly. And one of the pieces of information that I came across that I thought was just fascinating was that talking about photons, the human eye is actually an almost ideal photon receptor.
Right. So we have rods and cones. So rods are specialized for low light levels, right? And that's what we use in dark. But when the light reaches a certain intensity, the photoreceptors saturate. So you can't get any more information out of the rods. And so you switch to your cone system, which is less sensitive to light, and so it doesn't saturate as quickly. So you have this adaptation in going on in your eye that helps you detect a larger range of light intensities. And so, yeah, so it's fascinating. So these receptors can detect up to like one photon, I believe.
Right.
And
right.
And so they're very accurate detectors. And yeah, and that's just one example of how unique the nervous system is and how it's adapted for these specific roles.
So is the study of animal systems, such as you mentioned, birds have much greater vision than humans. I'm sure cats do too, for that matter.
Well, cats have more rods, so they can see better at night.
Okay.
So there's a shift from rods to cones in different organisms. So the nocturnal animals have more rods than cones.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that they see better, is that they see at lower light levels.
I see. My point, though, is will the study of animals who have different capabilities or what we would consider to be enhanced capabilities, will that aid eventually our own capabilities in terms of rehabilitation for people who have various forms of damage, and or somewhere down the line, even enhancement, you know. For example, now we have all the night vision equipment that dreamt that.
Right, so enhancement in the sense of enhancing our own senses, no, but building equipment that can, yes.
Right.
And so, like, bats use sonar for detection, and there are certain groups that study how bats do that, how they detect their own transmission. So they emit a sound, it bounces off objects and comes back to them, and they have to interpret that sound. And so they have to interpret the distance of the object and by the amount of time it takes to come back to them, and they have to selectively listen to that signal and ignore everything else. So one of the interesting things, so there is a professor at Brown who studied bats, and so his name is Jim Simmons, And he lectured on his research. And one of the things that I found fascinating is that he showed images of, like, you know, 50 bats flying around at the same time, and they're all using the sonar to figure out where they are and where everybody else is, and yet they don't interfere with each other. And so they've adapted so that they'll switch their frequencies depending on who else is around. And so that's one technology that the defense agency is really interested in. So DARPA, which is the defense, it's a research branch of the defense agency, mm-hmm. and they're the ones that developed the internet, and so they're the ones that funded the developing for the internet and everything.
Sure.
And so they're very interested in this type of research to enhance the ability of fighter jets and for to detect, you know, for sonars, for submarines and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so there's many examples of that that have been used and studied to understand how to build better equipment to do what we need to do.
My guest this morning is Dr. Jaime Mancilla, who is a postdoc at UNC, and we are talking about the brain in all of its permutations. Jaime, I want to transition a little bit into, let's talk about consciousness, because okay. that is such an intangible and something that's, I think, proven to be very difficult to characterize in scientific terms. But of course, ultimately, that's probably the biggest prize. Where are we today in terms of our understanding of consciousness?
We're very far. And so, like I said, there's different levels of understanding the brain.
Depends on how much coffee we've had at there this point in the morning, right?
There you go. And so you can start from the behavior and work all the way down to molecules. And so some people are studying consciousness. And one of the links they've made with consciousness is these waves that occur in the brain.
Sure.
And so there's waves of activity in the brain that people think have to do with consciousness. And so that the hard part about consciousness is that consciousness is not a function of one part of the brain. So it's not a function of a particular section of the brain. It's the whole brain activity. So everything that's going on in the brain is what causes consciousness. And so it's not limited to one particular area, so it's hard to study.
So it's a system-wide phenomenon then.
Exactly. So it's the activity of the whole brain that determines your level of consciousness. And so one example of this is, so your sensory systems send information from receptors to this nucleus in the midbrain that's called the thalamus, or that and the thalamus is a gate that transmit information up to the cortex. And so there's these waves that are set up from the cortex to the thalamus, and that determines the transmission of information. And so so that's part of consciousness, is that the conversation between the cerebral cortex and the thalamus and other regions of the brain. But it's really hard to determine what consciousness is. And so people like Francis Crick, that, you know, he was the person that became famous with the double helix of the DNA.
Right.
So he started studying consciousness, and he's one of the people that is involved in that field.
Well, I understand that there are studies going on fairly intensively these days to look at things like meditation and other forms of consciousness to help our understanding of what consciousness is all about.
Right. Yeah, so, yeah, meditation is one of the things that people have been interested in lately. And so I'm not really familiar with those studies, but one thing you can do is you can study what parts of the brain are active during meditation. Like if you ask somebody to think of a, you know, a beautiful place in the forest or something that they like to go to, and you can, you know, that calms them down, and you can see what part of the brain is active during that process of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that...
Didn't they study the Dalai Lama recently?
Well, the Dalai Lama actually came over here and gave several lectures on that. And so the Society for Neuroscience holds a meeting every year, and we had our meeting in D.C. this year, mm-hmm. or last year, actually.
Right.
And the Dalai Lama gave a talk there. I wasn't able to go because it was just way too packed. It was crazy.
I'm sure.
But yeah, so that's one of the fields that people are interested in now.
And what kind of knowledge might be emerging from that field of study?
I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure where they're taking that.
I see.
And so at the end, everything gets integrated.
Right.
And so whatever information they're getting from that can be integrated with other systems information that can be used for something.
I saw a study recently, which I guess was more from the psychiatric community, that said that if you had an important decision to make, that if you didn't think about it consciously, you were more likely to make the right decision ultimately. In other words, I guess letting your subconscious mind take control and kind of a Zen approach, actually.
Right.
And that just speaks to the varying layers of consciousness and just how complex the workings of the brain really are.
Right, right. And I guess in that field of study, one of the things that's interesting is sleep.
Sure.
Because, you know, as everybody knows, you cram for an exam, you'll do much better if you get some sleep the night before than if you drink coffee all night and you stay awake all night.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the fields of study is the consolidation of memory that happens during sleep. And so there's a lot of processes that go on during sleep that we don't really fully understand yet. And so that's a big field of study, is how all these memories get consolidated and how the brain functions during sleep.
And I would assume those kind of studies are occurring at the same kind of spectrum that you've described,
exactly.
all the way from
exactly.
the molecular exactly. to the genetic to the behavioral.
Right. And I actually had a friend that was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and he was studying sleep in Drosophila, which are fruit flies. And so it was pretty wild the way he was actually studying it. So the reason he was using the fruit flies is because they have a much more limited gene pool than we do, and it's much easier to identify the molecules that are involved in certain behaviors.
Yeah, well, there are scientists who spend their entire careers studying fruit flies.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And so he designed his experiments where he would have to keep the flies awake, right? And so he would, like, sit there and tap on some vials and make sure that they're awake. So I think he developed some machine to, like, tap on the vials or something. Because, you know, how do you know if a fruit fly is asleep or not, right?
That would be a good question.
So you have to keep it just moving and keep it active.
Uh-huh.
And so he would sleep deprive them, and then he would figure out what molecules had decreased or increased during that deprivation. And so... Yeah, so you can use different model systems to study the type of questions you're asking.
Sure. And what about the genetic basis of the brain and its activity? I know there's a great deal of work going on in that arena right now, and I know that that's not your area of specialization,
right.
But where do we stand in understanding the genetic
right.
components?
And so... The cells that I study are very specialized, and most neurons are very specialized, and so they have a set of proteins that they use that they that they express, but they all have the capability of expressing a variety of different proteins,
mm-hmm.
and so what set of proteins they express will determine their activity, and that's one of the things that has helped a lot is genetic the increase in the field of genetics has helped to understand what kind of proteins these cells are producing and help distinguish one type of cell from another type of cell. And so you can better understand what those cells are doing in the brain. And also the other thing that genetics has helped in is you can have knock-ins and knockouts of genes.
Sure.
So you take a gene out that you want the animal not to express to see what happens when they don't express that gene,
mm-hmm.
or you can put a gene in and see what happens when the cell's expressing that gene. And so one of the interesting things with that research that has helped me directly is you can insert fluorescent proteins into cells.
Right.
So you can have normal cells fluorescing, and so you turn up the light, you get a detector in your microscope, and you can detect these cells just because they're glowing in the slice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has helped in understanding what these cells are doing. You can study them much easier that way.
So you can see through the fluorescence the activation.
So right now what we're doing is just localizing these cells. So you have particular cells and you have millions of cells around, thousands of cells around, and you want to identify a particular one. It helps if that cell is glowing and you can look at it and say, oh, there it is. And so that's one thing there's millions of other things you can do with genetics, with knock-in and knock-out mouse. You can certain proteins that are, affect behavior can be knocked out, and so you can do all sorts of different manipulations with that.
Sure. My guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Jaime Mancilla from UNC, and we are discussing the brain and neurobiology. And we are going to take a short break, and we will be back in just a minute, and we will get into Jaime's work. Of course, science does have its lighter side, and each week here on Radio In Vivo, we feature some of the more amusing scientific stories that have come to our attention in the segment we call One Step Beyond. Well, just last week we were discussing the abominable state of science and math education, and this week I bring you anecdotal evidence of same. A friend of mine sent me some real-life science test answers from young students, and I couldn't resist sharing just a few with you. Unfortunately, I don't know the source of these treasures, but whichever valiant teachers collected them deserve our appreciation. Speaking of abominable, try this one on. The body consists of three parts: the brainium, the borax, and the abominable cavity. The brainium contains the brain, the borax contains the heart and lungs, and the abominable cavity contains the bowels, of which there are five: A, E, I, O, and U. Here's another anatomy lesson. The skeleton is what is left after the insides have been taken out and the outsides have been taken off. The purpose of the skeleton is something to hitch meat to. Three kinds of blood vessels are arteries, veins, and caterpillars. And here's one about what to do for someone who's fainted. Rub the person's chest, or, if a lady, rub her arm above the hand instead, or put the head between the knees of the nearest medical doctor. Sex education might need a little boost, too. Here's a couple. Artificial insemination is when the farmer does it to the cow instead of the bull. To prevent conception, wear a condominium. These kids are a little bit shaky on their chemistry also. When you smell an odorless gas, it is probably carbon monoxide. Water is composed of two gins, oxygen and hydrogen. Oxygen is pure gin, hydrogen is gin and water. To collect fumes of sulfur, hold a deacon over a flame in a test tube. Now that sounds like good advice. We'll share more of these gems of youthful scientific wisdom on future editions of One Step Beyond. In the meantime, join us again next week on Radio In Vivo for another exciting edition of One Step Beyond. Well, I'm sure we've all had our share of fun answers like that, and as we learned science growing up, and as I said, we're going to revisit that list. I just scratched the surface. And so far, we've just scratched the surface of our discussion of neurobiology in the brain with Dr. Jaime Mancilla from UNC, Department of Otolaryngology. Jaime, let's dive into your work. It's fairly complicated, but we're going to try to walk through it in lay language as best we can. Tell us about what you do every day in the lab.
Okay, so my work has changed throughout the years. I started off, my PhD work was in the visual cortex, so the cerebral part of the cerebral cortex that receives information from the eyes. And so I worked in the primary visual cortex, which is the first place in the cerebral cortex that receives that information. And I studied cells there in order, so basically the same type of circuit analysis that I'm doing now. And the prep that I used was turtles. And so...
Now what do you mean by prep?
So the animal that I studied...
Animal model.
The animal model that I studied was turtles.
Okay.
And so the way I have to do my experiments is I have to remove the brain from the animal, and then I have to study the brain in vitro. And so I put it under a microscope, and like we talked about before, the neurons communicate through electrical signals. So what I have to do is I have to stick an electrode into the cell and record that electrical activity to figure out what the cell is doing.
So you're using the electrode to stimulate the cell?
Well, no, to both. You can stimulate and record. And so you record the electrical activity of the cell so you can see what the cell is doing, and you can also stimulate the cell and make it act like it received an input. So you instead of the natural input that it receives, you can fake it through the electrode, and you pass a current through the electrode that will activate these cells as if they were receiving input.
So the cells in the living organism, that's how they're working.
Exactly.
As they're working, they're just simply receiving electrical information.
Right. And so, yeah, so the experiments I did for my PhD work were involved in the visual system. So what I actually did is I removed the brain from the turtle, and I kept the eye attached. And so what I could do is I could shine light in the eye and record activities of the cells in the cerebral cortex. And so the type of experiments I do are pretty hard to do in vivo. You can't, well, people have done this, but it's very hard to do. You record, record from single cells while the animal's awake and moving. People have done that now, but it's pretty hard to do, and you don't have the control that you have when the prep is in under a microscope.
Sure.
And so the type of questions I'm asking are very hard to address in vivo. And so what I would do is I would take the brain out, I would record from the cells, shine the light, and see what these cells were doing. And mm-hmm. And so there's particular types of cells that control the activity of the principal cells that receive the information and send it off to higher cortical areas.
So there are layers in this type of sensory perception within almost a hierarchy of information processing.
Yeah, exactly.
Within the brain.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, all sensory systems are like that. So in the retina, people don't really think about this, but the retina is a computer in itself. It's got several layers of cells in the retina in your eye. And so your eye is doing a lot of processing already, and it's separating the information to different streams and then sending these streams up to other areas. Mm-hmm. And so one of the places it's sending it to is the thalamus that we talked about before,
right,
which is this nucleus that is between the receptors in the periphery and the cerebral cortex. And so this nucleus receives information and then sends it up to the cerebral cortex. And so the areas I'm studying are the primary areas that receive information, but then they send it off to other areas for more further processing.
Sure.
And then, like we talked about consciousness, it's the activity of the whole brain. So this information gets transmitted to other regions of the brain, and then it gets integrated. So the visual information gets integrated with the auditory information, with the mm-hmm. Olfactory information, somatosensory, everything.
So is part of this processing that goes on in the brain what we take for granted, and it is something we all do involuntarily, selective sensory perception? In other words, our eyes are seeing everything available to us mm-hmm. at any given moment. Our ears are hearing everything available. Somehow that all gets blended together
right.
in the processing process to form consciousness,
right.
And I'm looking at you, not at the kayak sitting behind you.
Right. So that's attention. So a lot of people study the attention mechanism, And so, yeah, so you can do experiments to actually study that. And the way you do it is you can train animals to do a certain task and pay attention. Like if you have a computer screen and you can have several dots in there, you can have them pay attention to a particular dot in the screen and ignore everything else. And so you can actually study the attention mechanisms. And that also goes into the reward mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So you have systems that are involved in the reward mechanism that get activated when you expect to receive a reward for something that you did. For example, in animal studies, they get water or food as a reward for doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are certain systems that get activated when they do that also. So...
And those types of studies are also related to things like addiction, is that not
exactly,
correct?
Exactly.
Dopamine reward centers in
exactly,
the brain.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, so you do pay attention to a particular aspect of the information that you're receiving. And also when you sleep, you turn off all the sensory inputs. So you're able to sleep and ignore everything else that's going on around you, or some people can. I can't.
Well, the area that you specifically study, correct me if I'm wrong. The cells that you study are called inhibitory interneurons.
Correct.
Okay, and that is kind of at a mid level in this processing. Is that not correct?
Yeah, it's the functioning. The level I'm studying at is the functioning of these cells in a reduced circuit. And so, yeah, that's, you know, as we talked about studying from molecules, genes, and so this is like at a mid-level. And then, so I'm studying these cells that communicate with other cells, and they form a circuit that's the basic unit of functioning of whatever part of the brain you're studying.
Mm-hmm.
And so this basic nucleus, or this basic element, gets connected to other elements and they form like the higher circuits that are involved in consciousness and things like that.
So what is the importance of studying at this particular level? Is that kind of where a lot of the action is, and is that why it is of particular interest?
Well, it's of particular interest to me because I like the fact that you can study these cells, you can record their activity and figure out what they're saying to the other cells around. You can build on that. So you figure out what one cell is doing, then you figure out what another cell is doing, and then you kind of map out the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, in the cerebral cortex, you have these repeating units. And so once you figure out what one of these units is doing, it's much easier to understand what the whole cortex as a whole is doing.
So by focusing on one specific and kind of drilling down into one system, hopefully that will lend you knowledge about what the larger system is doing.
Exactly. And the other thing is you can, like I said before, is you can build models of, and so you get certain information, you can plug it into a model and have this computer model doing what the actual nucleus you're studying or the brain area you're studying is doing. And so one of the things that can come out of this is, for example, I went to a meeting of the Association for Research in Otolaryngology just about a month ago. And in there, one person was presenting their work. And so what they were doing is they're building computer circuits of this region that I'm studying now, which is the dorsal cochlear nucleus, which is the first station in the brain that receives information from your ears. And so they're building a computer chip to mimic what that nucleus was doing, and what their information they were using was the information that people like me and other people collect, and so they were integrating this information into like a little computer chip that you can use. So their idea was in the future you could implant into patients that have problems with their DCN. And so that's one of the...
DCN?
Dorsal cochlear nucleus.
Thank you.
So that's the place where I'm studying right now.
Sure.
And so one, yeah, so that's one of the ways that the field is going. Is
so what you're talking about with the models is refining those models so that ultimately that kind of technology that could actually be helpful in a clinical application, that will help refine that as well.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
Let's do talk about the cochlear nucleus,
okay.
Which is the area that you're specifically studying right now. I understand it's the first brainstem area to receive auditory information from the ears. Is that
correct?
Is that accurate?
Correct. And so the information comes from your ears, from the cochlea in your ears, which is the area where the receptors are. Mm-hmm. And so these receptors get activated with sound. They transmit information to the cochlear nucleus, which is the first place that it goes. And from the cochlear nucleus, it goes up to the inferior colliculus and then up to the cerebral cortex. Actually, the medial geniculate and then the cerebral cortex.
Oh, well, so I was going to correct you on that, but I was going to cut you some slack.
Right. And so the nucleus I'm studying right now is the first area that of the brain that receives that information.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same type of analysis I use in cerebral cortex, I'm using it in the dorsal cochlear nucleus right now. And so I'm studying what, you know, I study cells and how they communicate to each other. And one of the clinical implications of this type of work is to understand, to understand how hearing is processed in the brain.
Sure.
And second of all is to help with conditions where people are suffering from tinnitus or something.
Tinnitus being ringing
the
ears.
Right. And so the nucleus I'm studying now has been shown to have increased excitatory activity. So it's the activity is increased because of the tinnitus. And so, well, not because of the tinnitus. Maybe it's causing the tinnitus.
Mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
by understanding what, what the individual elements are doing in the circuit, so by understanding the cells and how they're acting, you can be able to control this tinnitus.
I think I mentioned to you when we were talking before the program that my mother actually suffered from tinnitus, for much of her adult life, had a ringing in one ear. And although it is not a life-threatening condition, it can, in fact, be quite debilitating in severe cases.
Exactly.
Would you foresee that this work that you're involved with right now will actually be able to offer some practical help to some of these patients? Because I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, right now there's really not a lot medicine can do for
exactly.
people with tinnitus.
And so, what they've tried now so far is like with people with tinnitus that is causing them not to function properly, is they've tried removing the cochlea when it's damaged,
mm-hmm.
Sectioning the auditory nerve, and none of that helps.
Right.
And so that's why we think that it's occurring further down in the pathway.
So it may be localized to the cochlear nucleus.
Right, that could be one region that's involved in this.
Okay.
And so that could be one region that's involved in maintaining this. So it's produced by trauma to the ear, and so loud noises will cause it. Overdose of aspirin, salicylate.
I know we've all experienced that from time to time. You go to a loud rock concert,
exactly.
and for 10 or 12 hours, your ears are going to ring. But
exactly.
in most people, it does go away.
Right, but once the level of the sound is too high, then it produces damage. And if it's sustained for a long enough time, it'll produce damage, and that damage can cause permanent tinnitus. And so, but by studying this area, we might be able to get a handle on what is causing this permanent ringing of the ears.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there's people out there that are building little circuits to mimic what this nucleus is doing. And so if they can get it mimic what the nucleus is doing, you could be able to implant it into the DCN and bypass the circuitry that's messed up. Or, of course, you can also have pharmaceutical agents that are specific for cells that are not functioning properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the type of cells that you mentioned before, inhibitory interneurons, are one candidate for cells that might not be behaving properly and that might be controlled through pharmaceutical agents.
I see. What types of pharmaceutical agents might apply? Because I know the getting through the blood-brain barrier is always a big issue.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of neurotransmitters and peptides that are released by cells. And so this inhibitor interneurons release a certain type of neurotransmitter, and that can be controlled by certain drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Benzodiazepines control that type of release. And the drugs that are used for anesthetics, they have effects on that particular cell type. And so you can use drugs like that and, you know, refine them to particular receptors in the target cells of these cells.
I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. Jaime Mancilla from UNC. And we've got about 10 minutes left in our discussion, and you are still more than welcome to join the conversation by giving us a call at 929-9601. Jaime, what about deafness itself? Certainly want to discuss that. I know that over the last 5 years, particularly, a lot of people have been helped by cochlear implants.
Mm-hmm.
How do those differ from the types of implants that you're talking about developing eventually?
Well, they're just more peripheral than, so they're further out of the nervous system.
So they're actually in
the cochlea.
In the cochlea itself.
Right,
the ear.
In the ear. Mm-hmm. And so you implant those, so it's less trauma to the patient because these are further out. You don't have to do as intensive a surgery to get to them.
Mm-hmm. Because implanting in the cochlear nucleus, we're talking brain surgery, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So these are more peripheral, and they've been developed for patients that have damage in their cochlea, but that have intact nerves and stuff. And so when that nerve is damaged, then these implants are not going to be able to help the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when other type of implants would come in handy. And I'm not talking tomorrow. I'm talking, several years down the road.
Sure,
that
sure.
This might come about. But, my participation is at the research level and basic research.
Of course.
And so it hasn't even gotten near the clinic.
I didn't mean to imply that you were sitting there actually tinkering with developing the implants, but that is the general direction of
the research. Well, that's the general idea where the field could go. I mean, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. one of the implications.
Well, and certainly over the last several years, the idea of implanting small electrical devices in the brain has reached the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in epilepsy,
it's
a treatment these days. So we're not talking science fiction here.
Right, exactly. They've developed those kind of implants before. And like we talked about before, the implants that are used for quadriplegic patients also have been implanted. So mm-hmm. it's something that's reasonable.
And Jaime, where are you looking to take your research in the future? I know that you've kind of wandered around a little bit, all within your area of specialization, but you've looked into some different areas already. Where are you looking to go in the future?
I'm not sure about that. Maybe the auditory
wherever
cortex.
You can get some funding, right?
Exactly. Maybe moving back up to the cerebral cortex and studying the auditory cortex, which has lagged behind the other sensory modalities. And it's interesting because you look at a science textbook and you have several chapters on the visual system, you have sensory systems, several chapters, and then you come to the auditory system and it's about one page or two.
right.
So the field hasn't been developed as far as the other senses, and so that's one thing that might be useful to do.
So you've still got a plenty of work to do.
Oh yeah.
Now, how is the funding situation? Is the federal government coming through on this and keeping the research going?
It everybody I talk to has problems with their funding.
Sure.
So investigators that have been in the field for like 20 years are having their grants rejected for the first time.
Wow.
Now.
Yeah.
So the funding is limited right now, and you know, there has been an explosive growth before, and so a lot of people submitted grants when the funding was good. But now the funding has leveled off, so all those people that had these grants are having their, you know, renewals rejected. So they can't renew these grants, so they're stuck in the middle of a project because mm-hmm. they can't renew their grants. So the funding level is not where it should be. And so that's one of the problems that we're facing, is it's hard to get funding to do the critical research that we need to do.
Indeed. Do you see that situation improving in the future, hopefully? Hard to predict?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it all depends on the politics,
or
right?
Or are your pleas falling on deaf ears, so to speak?
Well, I mean, it all depends on politics, where the government decides the money is more important.
Sure.
Which is not where it should be, but that's the government's decision, and we're stuck with that. So unless we have a government that decides to focus on healthcare and on, you know, improving people's lives.
Support for basic research.
Exactly.
Which is an ongoing issue, I'm sure.
Exactly.
So, Jaime, if you had an unlimited pot of funding coming through, blue sky, what would be the one thing that you would, what would be your dream project at this point? If you had the Mancilla lab?
Well, and so, I guess when I got into this field, I first studied psychology. And so I guess what fascinated me is how the brain was processing all this information. So that's why I got interested in the cerebral cortex, which is the highest level of processing. So my dream project would be to understand what the cerebral cortex is doing in general and be able to link all these different areas together and figure out, you know, what they're doing. And so understanding the cortex, I think, the cerebral cortex, I think, is one of the things that I would like to do.
But for now, you're really concentrating your efforts on the auditory system.
Right, for now. So I studied the somatosensory system before, the visual system before, mm-hmm. and so I'm kind of making my rounds.
Right. So maybe in a year or two, you'll be on the olfactory system.
Yeah, that's one system I might skip.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, another level of interest, and maybe that is where it all ties together, is that the cerebral cortex, as you say, is uh-huh. how all these systems interact.
Exactly. So they all get integrated cerebral cortex. So that's the place to be.
Well, you've been there, and hopefully we'll get you enough money to go back there.
There you go.
So, are you still like excited about this this work?
Yeah. It's very interesting. It's something that you know, you could do for years, and the knowledge that you gain is important for many applications. So yeah, I'm still excited about it.
Well, it's very fascinating work, and unbelievably, we are already out of time for this week. So, Jaime Mancilla from UNC, thank you very much.
Sure, no problem.
And,
pleasure to be here.
Want to encourage everybody to listen to Jaime and his guys as DJ Jaime on Saturday nights here on WCOM. Please join us on Radio In Vivo at the same time next week. My guest next week will be Karen Joy Miller, who is founder of the Huntington Breast Cancer Action Coalition on Long Island. And Karen more recently founded an organization called Prevention is the Cure, which is a national effort dedicated to improving health by cleaning up our environment. She's a fascinating speaker with a great deal to say, so I think it's going to be a terrific program, and I hope you'll make a point to tune in. My name is Ernie Hood, and you've been listening to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community. And we will see you next week.
I'm the operator with my pocket calculator. I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.